Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. All right, today's show, towards the back end of the show, really looking forward to this this segment of the show. We're going to be talking about one of Arthur Miller's plays. It's All My Sons. It's actually his first successful play, and it's a play about the voracious, inhuman, just get the hell off the planet spirit of capitalism and what it does to people. And we'll be featuring Joe Stern, who's the producer of the play, and Alex Morris, Angie Bird, two of the actors in it. Before that, we'll be talking with Andy Z. Once again, Andy is joining us to continue the conversation we had last week. Andy's spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and a writer for Revolution Newspaper. We're going to be continuing our conversation on the Occupy Everywhere movement and the big questions that are up, the juncture it's facing, the crossroads, the big questions that are up in the wake of the nationwide attacks on the movement and the road that's stretching ahead, which way forward. But before we get into all that, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show. We're having a lot of people back because what they say is so damn important. There you go. And I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Dennis Liu. He's a professor of sociology at Cal Poly Pomona. He's on the World Can't Wait Steering Committee. And he's the author of his latest book is Globalization and the Demolition of Society. Now, a couple months ago, we had a conversation with Dennis about his book and a lot of the questions that were focused up in this. I got a lot of response off of that interview, a lot of people calling up and writing and talking about how much they liked it. And I mentioned to Dennis then that I wanted to have him back to continue the conversation, so we're doing it today. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Sure. Happy to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this so we are able to get as much out of the time we have as we can. One of the questions I wanted to talk to you about, because it's so much posed in the world today, a lot more than you or I may have ever even thought that it was going to be in this quick a period of time, the nature of state power. State power, what is it that actually, what's so important about state power if you're thinking about changing the world?
Well, as I discuss in my book, that, you know, there are people in the world, both on the right and the left, who have been saying that state power is no longer relevant. You have people on the right who argue that government is the problem, as Ronald Reagan famously did and as his successors have been doing, while ironically seeking power in the very institution that they say they want to dismantle. And then you have some people, forces on the left, who have been saying, you know, we can set up liberated areas without reference to state power. And I think those, you know, that really state power is where is concentrated, the battle between the two agendas that we see in the world today, those people who want to privatize everything and militarize our societies and so on, and those people who think that state power is not relevant and that the very pursuit of state power somehow, you know, pollutes you or causes you to give up your battle. I would argue on the contrary that it is concentrated in state power. And that, in fact, the recent evictions of the Occupy encampments are an illustration of how state power continues to be relevant.
One of the things that when you're talking about the nature of state power, you really focus in on the rule of force and the matter of legitimacy. And you define political authority as the ability to get people to do what you want them to do, even if they don't want to do it. And you say, contrary to most conventional notions, therefore, the hard nucleus of state power is coercion, not consensus. This, I think, is something that goes right up against a lot of the conventional thinking about state power, especially in the broad movement circles these days.
Exactly. You know, what you're referring to is my citing the work of Max Weber, the famous sociologist, who was a conflict theorist, not a Marxist. He was anti-Marxist in many ways, but a conflict theorist nonetheless. But he was talking about, you know, he made a close study of state power, and he comes to conclusions that are wholly consistent in many respects with a Marxist perspective on that, which is another way that he puts it is he says that governments have a monopoly over the legitimate means of violence. The monopoly over the legitimate means of violence. And one of the things that gets challenged in what he did not pursue further, and I talk about further in my book, is that under what conditions does the legitimacy of their ability to use that force come under question? And when it does in a large enough way in the society, when enough people start to believe that the government's use of force is no longer legitimate, then their governments can continue to use force, but if you have an aroused people, some of whom at least are willing to die in the face of what they see as totally unacceptable and intolerable, then no government's going to be able to stand up against that. There aren't enough people that they can kill.
Well, tell me this, though. One thing is they do drown revolutions in blood. I mean, that does happen. Indonesia was a very, very clear case back in the 60s, you know, and I think that that
huge numbers.
Yeah. And I think that the significance of, you know, you talk in your book, too, about the significance, the real significance of understanding that the power of a state as a state resides in holding a monopoly over the legitimate use of armed force, as you're saying. But let's talk about why that is. I mean, because there's a state reflects something. It's not just a you know, something that people conjure up in their mind and say, hey, good idea, state, let's go for it.
Yeah, a very good question. You know, if you look at this question historically, when did governments appear and under what circumstances? Because we've not had governments for most of human existence. You know, people think they've been around since the very beginning, but this isn't true. Governments appear at the point when an economic surplus appears in society and when then becomes the issue of the distribution of that surplus. I give this example in my classes. I say, you know, here we are sitting in this room. There's, you know, 125 of us. And let's say there's a natural disaster outside, and we have to stay in this room for a few weeks. Somebody manages to, you know, get us supplies, water, and food so that we can survive for that period of a few weeks. And what if I was to say to you, since I have a PhD and none of the rest of you have one, you know, one, that I want to take 50% of these supplies for myself, you know, and would I be able to do this? And they say, obviously, no, we wouldn't allow you to do this. I say, well, what if I recruit a few of the biggest guys in the room here to be my bodyguards, you know, and I give them in return for their being my bodyguards a little bit more than anybody else here gets. That's really the nature of a state. It allows the maintenance of unequal distribution of the goods of the society. And the only way you can maintain that unequal distribution of the goods of society is through the use of force and the threat of the use of force.
So what does this mean in terms of, you know, the very popular question today of can we actually function in a society that runs by consensus?
Well, I think this gets into some very deep questions, which I spend a lot of time on in the book, about the issue of there's this person, Friedrich Hayek, who is really the godfather of neoliberalism, the idea of free market fundamentalism. And he argues that the essence of liberty is a person's ability to do what they choose, regardless of what somebody else wants them to do. And I point out that this is not really reflective of the real world, that in fact, not only are all of us subject to the will of other people under all circumstances, even kings and queens are subject to the will of others at times and have to abide by things that they don't necessarily want to do. But we are always social creatures. And moreover, we face objective necessities since we don't live in the Garden of Eden. And so abiding by the group needs is something that we always have to do for our very survival. And so because if you have a group of people, say, let's say for the sake of argument, 100 people, are you going to get agreement among all 100 people about what should be done? You know, what plans we should pursue and how we should go about it? It's not possible to get that kind of agreement. So inevitably, there is the need to get everyone to agree and to put to the side some ideas and some plans in the name of being able to implement the one that is decided upon as the best one to follow.
Have I
answered your question?
Yes. And I want to pursue that. I just want to remind listeners that they're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Dr. Dennis Liu, professor of sociology at Cal Poly Pomona and World Can't Wait steering committee member, and we're talking about some of the questions that he digs more deeply into in his book, Globalization and the Demolition of Society. Now, Dennis, one of the things, when you're saying that, I was thinking back to what you were talking about how the need for a state is rooted in the objective contradictions that we face in the world, and particularly when classes arose and all this. Now, if you get to a classless society, it seems like you're looking at a whole different way that in a communist world that things would be organized. You'd have administrative bodies, so maybe that would function as some sort of government, but not in the sense you'd have it today. You'd have administrative bodies that would also, you know, like what you say is there's a real danger of people failing to recognize the central role of force in politics. Now, that's today, but it seems like, and I'd like you to speak to that, and then there's what that danger there is. And then there's also trip out a little bit about in the future when there are no classes, when there's no longer a basis for any oppression and exploitation, that kind of that the role of force in politics would be wrong at the very least and non-existent, hopefully, at the best.
Yeah, so let me take the first part first,
sure.
The role of force. You know, maybe I can get into this by citing the work of Clausewitz, the very famous war strategist, and who said that war is the pursuit of politics by other violent means. In other words, that war is not something, you know, the open use of violence on a massive scale, which is really sort of the ultimate expression of the use of force by states, is not something separate and apart, independent of politics, but is in fact a continuation of politics with the open use of force. And on ordinary times, when you're not involved in wars, governments use force. They use compulsion upon people. If they couldn't use force, then they wouldn't have political power. And so force is not something that sort of we can somehow ignore or do without, but in fact reflects in a material way the existence of differences in the society. Cleavages around things like the distribution of goods, people's relationship to the means of production, and, you know, their ability to either be employers of people and dominate people through that way of exploiting their labor, or being forced because they don't own any means of production to have to work for the people who are, you know, essentially the capitalist class. So if you want to change society, you cannot ignore the question of force. Force is not something you can just take out of the picture. And then as to the question of tripping out into some kind of future scenario about the use of, you know, what would society look like under the circumstances where we eventually do finally get rid of social classes, which have not been around for more than, you know, they've been around for less than 5% of humanity's existence, classes. So the idea that we will always have to have them is really not in conformity with the historical record of human societies. Most of our existence was in pre-class formations where we lived in quite egalitarian conditions. So, yeah, I mean, I think that when there is no longer a society in which there is a lopsided distribution of the goods, and when the consciousness and capacity of the people has been raised to a high level where people are actively engaged consciously in participating in the society and making decisions about cardinal questions, then the need for a separate body of armed men, mostly men, will no longer be in existence. You won't have the need. You know, why did they deploy 1,400 cops to forcibly evict people from the city hall lawn at Occupy LA? Well, they certainly didn't do so because the majority of people wanted that to happen. The majority of people support the goals in this country of the Occupy movement. They did so because the people who are actually exercise power can only exercise power if they can control what is shown to people about what's going on. They could not tolerate the signs that were calling out and exposing the kind of corruption and the unfairness and the injustice of what's been going on under their policies.
You know, it's interesting, too, because there's a very different ethos they were doing, and pointing out that we don't have to live this way overall, even. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the idea that for the first time ever, that even the debate, which, and admittedly, there were a lot of different ideas about capitalism there, but the debate could be take such center stage position was just really incredible. And it was being debated throughout society, capitalism, good or bad, you know. A year ago, I wouldn't have thought that would have been the big debate, you know, in the LA Times or anywhere else. So, you know, and that leads us to another question here, Dennis, and you deal with this in your book as well. And just to remind people again, I'm talking with Dennis Liu, and we're talking about some questions drawn from his book, Globalization and the Demolition of Society. Now, Dennis, one of the things you point out, which I thought was very interesting in terms of the nature of the U.S. state today, and you actually pretty much define it in relation to the War of Terror in a lot of ways, that this has been a major, major development in the history of the U.S. imperialists. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, first let me say that this is something that isn't just happening in the United States. It's something that's happening across the globe, and it began happening in the 1970s. There's been a decisive shift away from in the nature of governance, and it's called public order policies, and most people have never even heard this term because it hasn't been named in mainstream discourse. But the essential change has been from prosecuting people, arresting them, and so on, for violating the law, and treating people as innocent until proven guilty, that has been shifting to a much really the kind of law that was exercised in monarchies, which is that the king is the law, the executive is the law. And you can be prosecuted and you are being surveilled, assuming that everyone is being treated as a suspect. Everyone is under surveillance. And so you see this thing happening under Bush. It's continued under Obama. In fact, Obama has taken this even further, where Bush would never have openly called for assassinating people with the president being serving as judge, jury, and executioner, as Obama has done. As he's done, you know, in the Alawaki case, for instance, who was an American citizen. And, you know, whether or not somebody thinks that Alawaki was a good or bad guy, let's assume he was a bad guy, okay? But if a president has the power to decide that he doesn't like you, and all he has to do is declare, well, you're a terrorist, and they can assassinate you through drone missile attacks or with the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act that was just passed by the Senate, which is codifying these new policies of public order policies, where the military now can pick you up, declare you a terrorist, and put you away indefinitely, and you have no right to challenge this detention. So, you know, that's straight-up fascist kind of norms. And so one of the points I make in my book is that this shift to public order policies is directly related to the war on terror, because the policies of neoliberalism, you know, the policies of capitalism in a world in which it is the only game in town in terms of who has power now, where there's no longer a socialist alternative, you know, in the form of a socialist camp in the world, you know, these are policies directed at and whose logic is basically the dispossession, the systematic dispossession and disenfranchisement of the vast majority of the people, the 99%. And when you're doing that to people, they are naturally not going to be happy with it. They're going to get rebellious. And so how do you quell that rebelliousness? Well, you have to use more force, and you have to find more justifications for the use of force and social control. And in fact, so we see across the board a tighter management of what is said through the media. We see many more appeals to trying to frighten people and get them motivated on the basis of fear. When people are afraid, they don't think very clearly, they don't think very rationally, and it justifies their moves to essentially abrogate due process. Due process is gone in our country and across the globe under these new policies, so that you can be called a terrorist simply by trying to appeal to your government, which historically is everyone's notion of, you know, the right of a citizen to be able to appeal to their government. So the war on terror is both a manifestation of this and also it is a product of these policies. It's exacerbating the contradictions in the world and the inequalities of the world. And it's creating by its very nature, that's the use of torture, for example, inflames people against the governments who are using torture. And so would therefore feed the anti-state terror versus state terror dynamic, and therefore give them more ground. So this action by Congress is simply, you know, a logical outcome, as I argue in my book, of a sliding slope for which there is no end point, as long as you argue that the war on terror must go on indefinitely.
All right. And on that note, we're going to have to cut it off for today and hope to join you again soon. Dennis, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much,
sure,
Michael.
Sure. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Dr. Dennis Liu, professor of sociology at Cal Poly Pomona and member of the World Can't Wait Steering Committee, and the author of his latest book, which is Globalization and the Demolition of Society, a very interesting book. Pick it up. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and writer for Revolution Newspaper, continuing our conversation on the Occupy Everywhere movement and the big questions that are posed up for that movement.
You've got to
right. Wake up to the world around you. That's Wake Up from Anti-Flag and their album The Terror State. Joining us now is Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're continuing the conversation we began last week about the crossroads faced by the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Everywhere movement and the big questions that people are up against right now. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Michael, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be following Dr. Dennis Liu, and I definitely agree, and a shout out to all those who have indeed woken up and to those who are just beginning to peel the crust from their eyes. And so let's go.
All right, well, let's jump into it here. Last week, we kind of left off at the point where we were talking about the crossroads that the movement faces. And in the period, in the intervening period, a massive police assault was carried out to evict the Occupy LA movement down around City Hall. And it was 1,400 cops, pulling a real shock and awe move. And this happened, though, in the face of tremendous resolve and defiance by the hundreds of people who were camped out there. There were over 500 tents. And on Sunday, which was the day that they had initially given the ultimatum, they had given the notice that at midnight, shortly after midnight on Sunday, so 12:01 a.m. Monday, they were planning to evict. And while the cops were lining up and doing all this, thousands of people came down to join the people who've been camped out at the site. Thousands of people, NoFX gave a concert down there. There was just people wandering, all kinds of people standing there in the night, resolved to say that we are not going to just cave in and walk away. That, there was a nonviolent civil disobedience, 292 people arrested. And it was just a remarkable note of defiance, but it was also a remarkable, massive display of force by the state. And I wanted to talk to you about, before we got into all of that in particular, that was more or less a background. I wanted to talk to you about, this is part and parcel of the whole savage way that these movements have been attacked around the country. And when we were talking last, you pointed out that at this point in time, the Occupy movement is confronting a tremendous crossroads. Let's talk about what that crossroads is.
Okay, I do think we have to step back and see that this was the L.A. Eviction, along with Philadelphia, actually at the same time, and was the last of the major evictions of the Occupy movement around the country. But we have to step back and not only recognize that these were nationally coordinated, but actually come to understanding what a intolerable threat the occupations actually are. And I say are and not was, even as I'm pointing to a crossroads, in that there is a tremendous basis to do some summation on what was the essence of these things, what is the essence of it, what is the direction they need to go, and how is that movement going to go forward, increasing the breadth of support and its determination and its targeting actually of the system itself. And so we just have to recognize, though, that this was intolerable because right at the seat of power in many cities, in New York, right at the seat of the financial empire, and on various campuses, which have been under assault over the last decade, not only for economically, but also because they have been centers of critical thought. At each of these places, there was a visible expression of people who put their lives on hold, whatever they were doing, to come and be in these spaces and say that the world the way it is intolerable. And when they were attacked by the police, they put their bodies, if not their lives, almost in some cases, on the line. And this gave a sense of hope to people all around the country with impact around the world that indeed we're not just taking it, that people can come together and that things indeed can change. And they changed the national conversation from one where the middle classes who are really hurting might be inclined to blame what they so-called entitlements and blame the poor, where you actually flip that dialogue to be against those who are on top of this system. So we need to get into that some more in this discussion, and including, I'm not trying to evade the question of what is the crossroads, but I think we won't understand that correctly if we don't actually look at what was accomplished, and then what is it that we're trying to do, and then how are we going to get there?
Okay, well, we will get into that, and I do want to say one thing in relation to this what's intolerable and what, you know, in relation to this. It really was, you know, I should let people know, too, that when the first eviction threat was actually turned back, for whatever reason, the police decided not to go in. That was very interesting. I think that a big part of the decision was looking at the spirit of the people that had come down there, what the price they would have to pay to do that. But it spoke something, too, to actually the whole point of, in L.A., where you had a situation where you had this, you know, the city trying to buy people off with these various deals for land and office space. And then you had them, you know, at the same time looking at, and you know, there were this massive display of force, which really, when they did bring the cops down, finally, they brought, you know, like I said, 1,400 cops, all kinds of weapons. And it really was a display, as Dennis was talking about, of at the core of all state power is this massive use of force to go, the monopoly on the legitimate use of force and the use of that to, in whatever form, to back up what they have to do. And in particular with this Occupy movement, the idea that this could not, they could not tolerate this staying alive and functioning as it was.
Yeah, I think that's what exactly what you saw, and I think we have to that movement itself needs to really and revolutionaries within that movement need to really come to recognize that it was that threat that had to be squashed, and including, as I believe I heard some of your discussion with Dennis, in spite of the fact that the majority opinion would have supported it continuing, exactly because it was concentrating something people feel very very, very deeply in terms of the great inequities in the society. I think, though, that we need to, I'd like to return to, well, what are the stakes of continuing, and how are people going to muster the ability to go up against all that's clearly been thrown at them now?
Right where I was going to go, so go ahead, man.
Okay, but what I was actually going to say, like, I want to step back even further from that, if I can first, to actually talk a little bit about what did this movement capture, and what will it take to, in terms of people's aspirations, and what will it take to overcome that? Because I believe that one of the things that was so exciting about it, I was at a couple of the Occupies, and certainly a lot at Zuccotti Park here in New York, is it did capture people's tremendous hurt of different strata of people, from people on the very bottom of society. Homeless people were beginning to flock to Occupy Wall Street. Yes, some sent by the police to disrupt, but actually people were able to work with people and try to overcome those divisions. And as well as the heart of Occupy Wall Street was a lot of students and middle-class people who found that their lives were being thwarted by the workings of the system. And they came together in very significant protests, including many people from Occupy stopping the Stop and Frisk program in New York, taking on police brutality that mainly is targeted at the people at the bottom. And you saw all this going on, and this was unacceptable. But we actually have to confront what will it actually take to overcome these great inequalities and overcome, as you guys were talking about, state power, which is fundamentally the legitimate use of armed force. But that some of this came out in what I heard, but that legitimate use of armed force is to enforce a certain kind of system. And the system is not just about the unequal distribution of wealth, but it's actually about who controls the ownership of the means of production, which Dennis did bring out later in the conversation, a whole class system where nothing gets produced in this society if it doesn't create profit for a group of capitalists or an individual capitalist. And this happens on a global scale, and the state exists to enforce these class relations. And it also dominates an entire infrastructure, a banking system, the media, all kinds of industries that it supports. It also, in a country like the U.S., it supports a whole global empire. The 700-plus bases in over 100 countries are not there to process passports. They're there to enforce a global empire. And the state also acts to legitimize the system through its elections, which really exist to put the stamp of popular approval on a system that actually works against the masses of people. So we have to understand all of this is concentrated and has to be grappled with in terms of trying to go up against and redress the tremendous inequity that people face. And maybe you can respond to this. There's tremendous inequalities, savage inequalities, that exist among the people, between men and women, the patriarchal society, between oppressed nationalities, and between the oppressed countries and the U.S., and between those who've had the privilege of working with their minds and the majority of humanity who only can work with their backs and in manual labor. All of this is posed, in a certain sense, with the Occupy movement, and I would like to have a chance to talk a little bit about what it would actually take to overcome this, and reference a piece by Bob Avakian titled A Reflection on the Occupy Movement and an Inspiring Beginning and the Need to Go Further.
Okay, we're going to get into that right now. But first, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Andy Zee, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about the Occupy Movement and the big questions posed before it at this juncture in history and in the development of that movement. So let's talk about that, Andy, because that is something that Avakian gets into very deeply in here, about what is it going to take to actually get from the desire that people are so strongly feeling and the situation that we're in today, and what's been cut loose through this movement. But what's it going to take to actually achieve these kinds of fundamental changes that you're talking about?
Yeah, this is extremely exciting that these kinds of conversations are going on, and they need to go on in the midst of people, if you will, coming back and hitting back at the other side even harder for having taken away these occupations. But I think, you know, one of the things, as I was saying, that you could see the unity that was begun to be built among different strata of the people. And it was very complex. We had to separate out the contradictions that exist between the Occupy movement and the forces who have opposed us, which is very sharply contended over the role of the police. Are they part of the 99%? No, they're not. They are actually acting in the interest of the 1%, regardless of their income, which is an example of why just the distribution of wealth and material goods is not sufficient scientific understanding to understand how society is organized, because people play a social role. But while there was beginning unity among different strata, there are also very complex contradictions that have to be begun to be examined. And Avakian points to that without a scientific approach to this large reality, these large problems that humanity faces now, we're not going to get to a different world. That a big thing in Occupy movement was a horizontal form of organization and a leaderless movement. This is inadequate to actually deal with overcoming the kinds of divisions that people face. In fact, and it even became people experience this in every Occupy that I went to, but certainly if you think about running all of society, it becomes really sharp. That if you simply say we're leaderless and everybody has the same right to speak, indeed, first off, what will happen sooner or later, and already began to happen in Occupy movement, is that those with a facility with working with ideas, those who've been trained in various philosophical and governmental ideas are going to come to dominate, and those who have been locked out of that will be subordinated to those who have that experience. And if you're actually going to work your way through the contradictions between these different social ills around patriarchy, around national oppression, and around this mental manual question, you can't do that without a very scientific understanding of why, number one, you do need state power to be able to really go to work on those divisions. And it better be a good state power, and it better be a state power that is working for a world where everyone can contribute whatever it is they can to society, and they get back what they need to live, a life worthy of being human, where there's no more divisions among the people in which some rule over and oppress others, robbing them not only of the means to a decent life, but also of knowledge and a means for really understanding and acting to change the world. If you want to bring that world into being, you're going to need a leadership that has an approach to do this and that is overcoming through a process of continuing revolution to minimize the need and eventually eliminate the need for that leadership, because you've overcome these great antagonisms that are very historically rooted and cannot just be wished away just because it sounds good. But indeed, you will replicate that.
We're talking with Andy Zee, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and writer for Revolution Newspaper. Now, Andy, one of the things you keep mentioning is this scientific understanding, and I think it'd be helpful for people who are listening who might not be aware of or might not understand what you mean by a scientific understanding. And I'd like to have you speak to that in relation to as well, and I know I do want to speak a little bit to where to from here for the Occupy movement. And I, there's also the question of, You know, Avakian makes the point that these Occupy protests can be a significant positive factor in contributing to the revolution that is needed if this is approached by those with the necessary scientific communist understanding. In accordance with that understanding and the strategic orientation that flows from it, what does it actually mean? And how do you see the relationship between people who are fighting for a much, you know, for right now consciously fighting for a communist world and people who are occupying these squares?
Well, I mean, first off, I think one thing people need to do is you know, it's even what questions are you posing? And I just have to say, I would encourage people very much to go down to Revolution Books in L.A. or in other cities where you're listening to this, and also to go online to revcom.us and download and take a look at this reflection on the Occupy movement, Inspiring Beginning, The Need to Go Further by Bob Avakian, and also take a look at the draft proposal for a constitution for a new socialist republic in North America that concentrates a scientific approach to a new society. What do I mean by scientific? I mean something that is actually starting from reality, from the world as it actually is, and then on that basis is theorizing, developing an understanding of where the world could possibly go, including understanding that within the potential pathways for this change, there's also obstacles, and has an understanding of that and the ability and strategy and program to be able to lead through that. And then ultimately, whether or not this theory is correct and leads to that liberation is tested in the world. And in fact, communism as a science, like any other science, is one that gets ultimately verified by changing the world. And put a different way, a basic Marxist understanding of freedom is the recognition and the transformation of necessity. What does necessity mean? It means the things that impinge upon us the way the world actually is, whether it be the natural world or the social relations that we inherit from previous generations, and the transformation of that necessity. And this is an ongoing process, which is why communism is not a closed system or should not be a closed system, and to the degree that in the past some people have viewed it as such, has been a problem that Avakian has actually been struggling around and his work is all about, to tell you the truth, in terms of putting communism on a more scientific foundation, which means much more closely really linked up with an approach that values the truth and the world as it actually is and how it can be changed. And this is something that's extremely exciting because and extremely necessary because the world as it is today is an unbelievable horror, and that's not coming from some intrinsic human nature to screw over other people or for greed, and then you need a state to keep us from our worst nature, or people say you don't need a state because it will only give rise to our worst nature. No, these are actual problems that we've inherited. And that's what we're trying to overcome. So you want to overcome the inequality between people, you have to have an approach that proceeds from understanding where does that inequality come from? How do we overcome it? So let me give you that as a beginning approach to what a scientific approach is. It's your description of reality and your prescription for how to change that has to itself be rooted in that very reality.
Now, we have about 2 minutes left, and I know I always do this to you, but we have about 2 minutes left, and I'd like to, you know, just a little, if you can talk a little bit about this question of, well, what does it mean in terms of people taking up this? What's the relationship between the two? How do you see these things being working together as opposed to separately or just running alongside one another? How do you actually see them working together and one contributing to the other?
Well, I think how they work together is I think we all actually do need to put our heads together and develop a way to come back at this and come back at it in a way that doesn't become either, on the one hand, co-opted by the system and get reasonable now so that we can have winnable gains under this system, which will only mean more misery for the masses of people here and around the world, or on the other hand, to punitize the whole thing and find some safe haven of protest somewhere off to the side. This is why the city administration in Los Angeles offered people office space, a farm, this and that, and to their credit, Occupy LA turned it down, because what really mattered is this stand that people were taking outside of politics as usual. And Occupy now has had for the last 30, 40 days a metaphoric meaning throughout society, but that metaphor depends on some actual taking of political and actual space. It's beyond the scope of this conversation, and revolutionary prudence to discuss what that should actually be, what form it takes in relationship to foreclosed houses, new occupations in different parts of the city. But I will say this, it means building much broader unity, taking the thousands who came down on Sunday night in L.A., the tens of thousands who showed up in New York, 30,000, and after that, was those people have to be marshaled to bring forward tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people more, and it has to be even more determined. We, you know, day 19 of the Egypt Tahrir Square uprising took 6 months to reemerge. We should not take 6 months here, but it doesn't get easier, but it does. It is essential, because if you leave this system intact, not only will it mean continued suffering for people here, but it will mean continued suffering on a horrific scale for the masses of people throughout the world. And this is why people need to seriously check out the revolutionary movement. They need to check out Bob Avakian's work. We need to argue about it. We need to debate it. I know you can't be too rude in doing that, in the sense of that we really should have some vigorous struggle, but the idea that we're going to get through this with on some kind of easy path is just does not correspond to the way things actually are. And I just want to say that, you know, as a saying going around, you can't evict an idea whose time has come. That's actually the positive part of that, is there are ideas whose time have come, including communism on a world scale. But when you lose communist states in the world, which we have lost over 35 years ago, it matters. You know, when the Library of Alexandria was burned to the ground, we lost science for 800 or 1,000 years. To have the truth will not set you free. Avakian has pointed it's part of that process, but it actually has to be fought for, and diverse forces have to be cohered around it, and then there's a struggle that's on. And right. That's really where things need to go.
All right, on that note,
the big ideas and fighting the power and transforming people for revolution.
That's great. All right. And on that note, we've got to wrap this up, Andy. Thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again, Mike.
Look forward to talking to you again, man. Take care.
All right. Be good.
Bye now. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Joseph Stern, Alex Morris, and Angie Bird, and all involved with the production of Arthur Miller's play, All My Sons. So stay tuned.
Pick up on this. Pick up on this. Hey, I'm a greedy man, greedy man, I'm a greedy man, I'm a greedy man, hey, I'm a greedy man, now brother, don't leave the home we're undone. Hey, 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 now brother, don't.
All right, welcome back. And I couldn't get it any better than that. I'm a greedy man from James Brown. And joining us to talk about greedy men, greedy people, greedy women, greedy everyone, and greedy systems are three folks from the Matrix Theater production of Arthur Miller's All My Sons. Joe Stern, the producer, and you're the producer of the play and at the theater in general, right?
Yes, we've been there for over 30 years. We're a company.
Right. And Angie Bird, who plays Kate Keller in the play.
Hi.
Hi. And Alex Morris, who plays Joe Keller in the play.
Yes, that's me.
You know, ever since I saw it, I just keep looking at you and saying, Joe, how you doing? So you won't mind. Well, let's talk about this. Why don't we start with you, Joe? Why don't you give people a sense of what the play is about?
What the play is about?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's about many things. I think it's about greed, denial, love, you know, the major themes of our lives that Arthur Miller wrote. He wrote really... I think most of his plays, in a way, are Greek tragedies. I think they're timeless, even though this takes place in 1947. The issues in the play about, you know, corruption in terms of war materials, faulty war materials, is still in the newspapers 60 years later.
What the devil, you say?
You know? But the virtue, what the production is really mostly about, what your listeners don't know, is that it's been cast multi-ethnically. There's four different families, and there's the two actors that are here. The father is African American, the mother's white, and the son is what's the word? He's half and half, but I've lost the word. He's a product of both parents of different ethnicities. And then there's the neighbors. There's white neighbors. There's Latino neighbors. And there are an Asian family as well. So I don't think it's ever been done this way, at least except for high school.
I was going to ask you. I'll ask you and then and ask you guys what you think of it. You know, to me, I mean, look, Arthur Miller's plays generally, you know, he writes about white people, basically. I mean, in a sense, right. He's writing about all people, but his stories actually are grounded in the experience of white people in society. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious, what led you to want to cast this way?
Well, a couple of different reasons. I don't want to take up too much time, but we've been dealing with the subject of race in different ways for the last 3 years with the play called Stick Fly and then Neighbors and now this one. And basically, it was to show that as Alex just said to me, that this is another this is an American classic that is timeless, and that to engage the audience in a way to deal with the issues and the story of this play and break down their conditioning and ultimately hope that it's a kind of healing act for both the audience and the actors who get a chance to voice parts that they would never have an opportunity to do, at least in the American theater.
And let me tell people that the play is All My Sons, and I have to tell you, I went to this thing and I sat there and I was, and oftentimes I go to a play and I'll have a real immediate reaction. It's just sort of like either I like it or I just like don't want to touch it or something or whatever. But this thing, this play in particular, really really got to me. I mean, I was just watching it and for many different reasons that I'll get into in a minute. But and you were talking about so you came into this play. Have you been in Arthur Miller plays before?
I actually did this play about 8-9 years ago.
So how did you feel about the way it's cast? And I mean, it adds a whole new dimension to it. I think it's really interesting.
Absolutely it does. And when I was first approached, my first response was, well, you can't do that play like that in 1930, blah, blah, blah. And my second response was, I want to be the one to be doing it. And it's been a grand experience. First of all, in truth, each of the parts in this is much better cast in terms of the personal psychology or passion that each of the people brings to their specific things. It's just, there's no comparison. And it's been a grand experience for me.
Joe, or Alex. Joe.
I like that.
See, I told you,
I
there
like
it goes.
That.
Okay, Alex, what about you?
Starting as an actor first, I would never dreamt that I would get an opportunity to do an American classic at a prestigious theater. I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity when I met Joe and he asked me about it. I was like, yeah. I mean, I did Stanley in Death of a Salesman at the Alley in Houston maybe 10 years ago. And to them, that was non-traditional casting. So for this one, it was very intimidating at first. Because it is a classic play, and people are familiar with it, and like you just stated, it's basically a white play. But if you read the play, there's no mention of race. My approach was as a father and as a man with a family. None of the other things that came along with it, I first approached it as a human being. And if you approach it from that angle, from that pinpoint, then everything else kind of grows out of it. Then I get to work with the wonderful Angie Bird. I mean, what else? I mean, what else can you do but be excited and happy about that?
There you go. You're just making up for all the bad relationship in the play. But here's the question, though. Because when you're doing this, I mean, one of the things that hit me, and I know a lot of people talk about, and August Wilson did a whole big thing about in black theater, how it couldn't be just colorblind casting, you know, that you actually had that. There's a very important part to black theater. I don't think that's the same question when you're talking about theater of a dominant nationality in a place that whose culture has actually dominated the scene. But I also think there's a point to some of the things you were talking about, Joe, about the Greek, like the similarity to Greek tragedy. And I think that you were talking about too, Alex, the point of... There's something in there that is very universal.
Absolutely.
And I think the casting actually makes you step back and see that. Because my first response is, you know, look, the character you play is really he's kind of folksy. He's you like him. He's kind of the cat who's is in the backyard. He's drinking a beer. He's hanging out.
Right.
You know, he's playing cards with the neighbors, all this stuff. And he's got a family that does all this stuff. And the same thing. And even if you're looking at, okay, this is not, on one level, you can say, in some circles, this is not that unique. But I'll tell you what, in a lot of neighborhoods, it's very unique, to have this kind of mixture of people of different nationalities. You know, but at the same time, one thing that struck me is, you know, there's a tendency, I think, for people to look at, like, many of the people who've been cast are people who normally are on the downside of oppression in terms of what happens in this society. And you've cast them in a way where, actually, I mean, your character is actually somebody who, yes, he's getting screwed over by capitalism. On the other hand, he embraces it to a
Absolutely.
Certain extent, you know?
Absolutely.
And to me, it's like you're forced to step back and say, wait a minute, and you examine bigger issues right away. So it was tripping out on that. Go ahead.
I just want to make one comment, which is not my own, but a writer came to the show who said, and I've said it a few times since, he said that what hit him, because he advised me not to do it this way. And he said, he came back at intermission and said I was completely wrong. And at the end of the show, he said to me, he said, you know, this show, this production is prophetic. It's not about the past. It's about the future. And it's kind of what you're saying a little bit, you know, in terms of its timelessness, in terms of its issues, which are really relevant. I mean, if you just look at Occupy, yeah. Everything.
Well, I was just thinking of this point that was in the Anti-Flag song I played earlier on, where it was like, wake up and pay attention to the world, basically, you know, which is actually a line that's thrown at your character, Alex, from the guy that plays your son,
right.
Which was there's a whole universe out there that you're responsible for. Like, check it out, step up to it. So, you guys have a little piece of the play you're going to do?
Yes.
Okay. So
this is how we start. Joe, did you take a bag from under the sink?
Yeah, I put it in the pail.
Well, get it out of the pail. That's my potatoes.
I thought it was garbage.
Do me a favor, Joe. Don't be helpful.
I can afford another bag of potatoes.
Oh, Minnie scoured that pail in boiling water last night. It's cleaner than your teeth.
And I don't understand. I worked 40 years. I got a maid. Why am I taking out the garbage?
Well, if you'd make up your mind that every bag in the kitchen isn't full of garbage, you wouldn't be throwing out my vegetables. Last time, it was the onions.
I don't like trash in the house.
Then don't eat.
You know, it's funny. Once upon a time, I used to think when I got money, I'd get a maid, and my wife could take it easy. Now I got money, I got a maid, and my wife's working for the maid.
It's her day off. What are you crabbing about?
Okay.
One of the more comedic elements in the
right,
play.
Right, yeah, and it rolls on from there. Okay. All right, let me give listeners a quick reminder. You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Joe Stern, Alex Morris, and Angie Bird, the producer and three members of the cast of a really unique production of Arthur Miller's play, All My Sons. And I mean, this production is one that will sit with you for a long time. It's a production that has a multinational cast, a multi-ethnic cast, in a play that's traditionally all about white people. It actually is. It's just a wonderful play. And it's interesting because there is, I think, particularly the point about a lot of Arthur Miller's work as a critic of capitalism. You know, and even though he finds, you know, I think he also finds different ways that he can try and make people understand some of the, like I said, the fact that your character, Alex, is just somebody who's embraced but swept along as well and made to do things that are just unconscionable but also are things that he's buried very deeply. And your character, and it's the same thing in the sense of, you know, which actually has driven your character almost to this, on the border of insanity, actually, which is very, very heavy when you think about, again, conjuring up all the things about the people who are most oppressed, women, black people, Asian people, all the Latinos, all these coming together and playing in this play and really playing not just victims, but actually perpetrators of capitalism
yes.
as well. And, you know, one thing is this play, particularly the resonance of this today. Now, you started this play just about the same time that Occupy Wall Street began, right?
Actually, before.
Ah, yeah.
We started rehearsing. Well, I've been thinking about doing this play for 2 years, but it's been on the schedule since May or something.
So you're responsible for Occupy Wall Street, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want to say it.
Go ahead. What do you guys draw out of this?
What do you mean?
Just in terms of yourselves, what do you take from it? What do you guys take from it?
Oh, my God, that's an excellent question. I've learned so much personally as Alex, getting to know the people that are in the cast. We have become a very close group, and I've learned so much from the different cultures. One night in particular, Madex Sell, the young lady that has one of the roles in the play, had a birthday party, and she had her friends come to the theater that night. And after the performance, they played for her birthday. And she's a Puerto Rican young lady. And I mean, just being in that atmosphere that night, I mean, I was just not drunk on the liquor or anything, but just drunk on the atmosphere and on the love and on the music. And for me, that's the thing that has been the best part of this experience.
All right. And?
Oh, it's...
We'll do it.
I don't know where to go with this. I just know that for Joe and I, for Alex and I, it's been really, the important thing is that we both know what it is to be married for a long time, more than, you know, any ethnicity.
Right.
Well, that's it. And I do think, actually, that, and I don't know, Joe, if you have anything you want to add in.
Well, the only thing I would add to that is that it has been one of the objectives of this whole project is not just everything in the front of the stage for the audience and their experience, but to bring people together of different ethnicities. And I was saying to them, I've been doing this for 35 years. This is one of the closest companies that I've ever had. And the exception of one person, nobody knew each other before they came into the production. And I think that that has accomplished one of the things that I was very much after, which is the kind of healing and getting past race.
And actually, I think actually one of the things I noticed was in the audience, the people at the break in the show, the audience was talking about the show, which was really is always a very good sign. You know, no one was going out looking for their car. They were talking about the show and what was being posed there. So I want to thank you all for coming in today and remind people that the play is All My Sons. All right, well, that about wraps it up for today. I want to thank all of my guests today, Dr. Dennis Liu, Andy Z, Joe Stern, Alex Morris, and Angie Bird. I want to thank all of you for tuning in, each and every one of you. It's important that you tune in each and every week and let me know what you think. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And before we leave you, I want to leave you with a quote from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and this is from his book, Basics. And it really is a very fitting quote for everything that's going on in the world today, especially with the Occupy movement and the state of the world. All right, so here it is. In a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequality, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule, and it will uphold and promote that kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is, which class will rule and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation or the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation and oppression and inequality. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his new book, Basics, which you can find out about getting basics by going to revcom.us/basics. All right, I want to once again thank everyone who threw in for the show today. I want to thank my board op, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and again, each and every one of you for tuning in. We're going to go out now with State Run Radio from Lupe Fiasco.
You must be a radio station, and who are we? We must be a number one song spinning all day long. And over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. And we don't wear what we call it, and nothing's free sounds to me. This broadcast to bring you the special message about the forecast. The future's cloudy and it's raining on the poor class. Road to peace is closed, heavy traffic on the warpath.